This is Jason Horsley and The Liminalist, the podcast between part four of my discussion with Anne Diamond on Leonard Cohen, MK Ultra, and cultural engineering. My favourite Cohen has always been Various Positions, and I don't know if we'll have time now, but I really wanted to get into this whole question of art as technology and weaponized memes, and just because somebody, when I first posted your piece, actually I hadn't remembered, but it was back in May of this year at a forum I have called KubeCon. Somebody posted, well, that's all very credible. He's ex-Israeli, actually, but anyway, it's all very credible, but does it mean that there's anything wrong with the music, or does that make the music in some way tainted? And that to me is a really crucial question, and because it's almost unthinkable. I mean, for me personally, it's not unthinkable because I'm being forced to explore this more and more now. The kind of cultural artifacts that I've used, you know, to, you could say, to medicate myself, but that have given me pleasure and that have given me a sense of identity, that have reinforced a certain kind of identification. And Cohen was definitely one of the key figures for me, yeah, in terms of identification, not from an early age, but from my early 20s. I discovered him through my brother, who you know about. He had I'm Your Man, and he played it over and over again. And the first time I heard it, because of those really kind of cheesy sounding singers on Manhattan, I just kind of picked that up and I said, what is this crap? And he was a bit put out. But then he kept playing it, and of course the next song, everybody knows, it does get better. But anyway, it got through to me, and soon after that I bought it, and I really got into the I'm Your Man, and then I bought Various Positions, and this was an absolute turning point in my life. And actually, we're talking, weirdly, it just occurred to me at exactly the same time. This was late 1991, when I disinherited my fortune. I went through this total collapse of my world because of this woman that I was in love with who didn't reciprocate, and I had all these plans to become, to bring in the new age with this partner. We had this kind of messianic vision that we were going to implement and bring about in New Mexico using my fortune from my family business, the Fabian family business. And it all fell through because I had put all my eggs in one basket, and the basket was this woman. Essentially, she was my primary motivating force, was to be with her. And when she said no, that was it. And I'd made this oath that if I can't be with her, I'm going to die, right? And so when she said,
"So you were in your 20s when this was
I was
up.
23, yeah, 24.
Terrible time. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. And so my impression was that Cohen was, his music was helping me through this time, but now I'm looking at it through a different lens. So, because what happened was, when she said no, because I'd made this oath that I was going to die, I realized, well, I'm not going to kill myself. I just don't have it in me to commit suicide. I never have. Hope I never will. But I had to see through this oath I'd made. I couldn't face my life without this person. So I decided that I would just disappear from the map. I would get rid of all my money, and I would go off to some foreign land and disappear where nobody would find me, and I would just, you know, I would let life take care of me. I would, you know, put myself in such suicidal circumstances that I couldn't possibly survive. That was basically my plan of how to die without committing suicide. And right about the time I was making this decision, I took LSD, and I'd just bought, because I was in London, I'd bought Various Positions, and I took it home, and I was in this crisis in my mother's house, and I had taken LSD with this girl that we were saying goodbye to each other, and we took LSD, and actually it didn't kick in until after she'd left, but it was like our final goodbye, and we were just lying on the floor weeping for an hour or something, and then she left, and the LSD was kicking in, it was quite mild, and I put on Various Positions for the first time, okay, the first time I'd heard it. And when Heart With No Companion came on, so I guess I'd listened to most of the album, within the first few beats, I knew, this is going to be my song.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even heard the lyrics, but somehow I knew. I can't remember what happened, but my attention was completely captured by the song, and I something happened anyway, and then the lyrics came, and of course it was my song Heart With No Companion, and it became my song.
And it did what?
It became my song, and this was the night that I pretty much that I made a decision to die. So, you know, I don't want to get too fanciful and say, oh my God, I was triggered by that album, but just as a kind of case study, I mean, just to put it on the table as, you know, is that entirely coincidental? Particularly the fact that this was happening right around the time that you're talking about, where Cohen was going through his breakdown. I mean, this, we're talking about implicate order, mysterious forces. It's so much deeper than we know. And, you know, whatever caused me to identify with Cohen was, it wasn't volitional, it wasn't conscious, whatever, you know, I emulated my brother, whatever drew him to Cohen, that resonance through trauma, that matching trauma. Mm-hmm. So it does seem entirely possible to me that, I mean, art is not what we think it is. It's a kind of technology, let's say, that songs can be designed. And so this idea that I've had for my whole life, and I was indoctrinated with this by my family because they worshipped artists, celebrity artists, of course, but still.
Yeah, I know.
This idea that you could judge somebody by their art, like if they're a good artist, they're a good man, and that good art only came from the soul. This is a belief that I've had my whole life. So the idea that Cohen could be this kind of person, this double agent who's capable of all kinds of things that totally make him not a good person, could create beautiful art, that seemed like that's cognitive dissonance, right? It just couldn't be. But it is. I mean, that's where I'm at with Cohen, and it's not the first time, but it's the latest time where I'm just having to say, okay, I took those songs on, I internalized them, I even learned some of those songs. I can sing like several Cohen songs on guitar. I played Passing Through at my mother's funeral. I did a duet of Heart With No Companion with my wife. They've become like really personal items of my identity. This makes me think of the Cohen line, I thank you for these items that you sent me. and I have to consider that they're poison, you know? That they're part of this larger meme, weaponized meme, that he was, not that they're 100%, of course, it's not it's either one thing or another, but that really I want to be free of that. I want to be free of that whole influence, because you know, it has this whole hidden aspect to it that, and this to me is the kind of the essence of what we're doing, is trying to uncover the hidden narrative, and that does mean destroying the false narrative, the cover story, in a sense, not by attacking it, but by, once you see what's underneath, it's like one of those images where you look at it and you think it's an elephant or whatever, but then you take a few steps back and you see other elements in it that you hadn't seen, and it's a completely different animal.
Right. Well, definitely. that's what this sort of does. It's also about, you know, figure, it's about, you know, the way the, you know, in all Disney cartoons with Mickey Mouse and the, no, figure and ground, you know, the positive and the negative, and that's a, anyway, I saw an exhibition where they talked about Mickey Mouse, and it's really the backgrounds that are programming people in the Disney films, Mickey Mouse is really the negative space, and what's actually the positive, the message is in the background.
Oh, that's like the magician, the sleight of hand, directing the attention away from what's actually happening.
Yeah, but your subconscious is pulling all of it in, you know? And, you know, when you were talking, I mean, I know what you, I don't think it's poison. I think there's a poisoned element to it, definitely. And I think until people grow up, you know, and are open, I haven't ever met anyone like you, frankly. You know, I don't know anyone who can hold a conversation like this, who's, you know, who's interested and who can just basically, you know, contain this information. Most people can't. They, you know, they either hate or they love, you know. And I'm not a big fan of saying everything is dual, you know, it's a dualistic universe and evil is good and good is evil. You know, I'm not a...
Right.
That's Freemasonry and that's Sabbatai's right. Vino, but Kabbalah, you know. But there's some truth in it, right? There's something, there's some lesson there. And you talk about beauty, you know, you talk about how can you write these beautiful songs? They must come from the soul, they must be true, they must be, you know, how, you must be, that must be goodness. Well, but in the Kabbalah, beauty is Tifereth, and I think it's right in the center.
Yeah.
I have to look that up. And it's kind of considered to be, in a way, a world apart. It's nothing to do with good or evil. It's kind of in its own separate realm. And there's a lot written. I don't read that stuff anymore. I used to read it. But another thing that occurred to me, you know, for example, I thought of Sabbatai Zvi when you were speaking, and how they said when he was in an exalted state, he would compose beautiful songs.
Mm.
And that's the other thing that really reminded me of Leonard, you know, that he seemed to slip into this exalted position where godlike or, you know, or heavenly or angelic. And then Sabbatai Zvi would then plunge and be in hell with demons, and he'd be, you know, wrestling with them, and they would possess him, and he'd have to crawl all the way back up to the... That's when you read about him, those are the kinds of stories that you read about, that things he talked about, things people said, you know. And so I think it's highly possible that some Cohen songs were written in a very angelic place, like Sisters of Mercy might be one, and maybe Heart with No Companion, because I really like that song. I don't want to hear it anymore, but when he first recorded that, and I heard him sing it, I think it was in Dublin, and I'd never heard it before, and I was moved to tears, I think, by it. I felt it was my song. It was, you know, and the same, I had a similar reaction to it, you know? And there's a few others of his songs, I think, are on that level. But then there becomes a point where his songs seem to be mechanically, they seem very calculated, you know?
Well, and don't you think, though, I mean, is it an either-or thing, or is it a spectrum? Because
spectrum.
It seems to me that...
Yeah.
I mean, because it's too easy to say, oh, well, this song comes from angelic place because I like it, right? That's essentially what we end up doing, and that's why I end up then pulling in the other direction and going to another extreme, which is it's all poisoned, and I know that's not exactly accurate too, or at least poison can be homeopathic, right? It's the right doses, and it's how
there
we ingest
bet.
It. But there's something about... And this is personal, but I think it's also quite universal in our culture, how art is a technology that is employed for social engineering purposes, and that because we're conditioned by culture from day one to kind of to be complicit with this use of the technology that we call art, we use it also. And so I use the term medication, but I mean that's perhaps not exactly the right term, but that if something makes us feel certain feelings, then that makes us feel good, and we say that's art and that's beauty. But that doesn't make it angelic. That doesn't make it truthful. That's like I was saying to you at the beginning of this conversation. For me, feeling good is actually less desirable at this time in my life, and definitely less trustable. I trust it less than feeling good in a feeling of badness. I don't know. We don't have words for it, but lately I've been feeling like really like almost like I'm dying, and yet I know I'm not. Well, except that everyone is, but it's a kind of just a feeling of being on the edge of something really terrible, and along with that, there's this sense of that this is good. It's not even a sense. There's just there's a good feeling there, because, and I don't even want to say because, I can interpret it and say it's because I'm on the verge of integrating something in the unconscious that's really frightening, and I think that's probably accurate, but it's kind of, the point is I don't know. All I know is that something's happening, and it's not like how good it makes me feel isn't the measure of how real this is or how genuinely transformative is.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so this is the thing I'd say about art and Cohen's songs specifically. Yeah, he wrote some beautiful songs, but at the end of the day, so what? If he was running around killing people and, you know, whatever else he was up to, I don't really want to partake of that. I really don't. It's like a rotten tree, rotten fruit.
Well, rotten century, you know, rotten
True.
world. And you know, if people, I think better to s to sense the duality of it, you know, the dark side of it, is, than to pretend that it's all light and that it's all beautiful. But and I think also art, maybe beauty, you know, the whole thing around that, it's the wrong place to look for spiritual meaning. I mean, you can find some, but ultimately it's not going to be there. That's, you know, but I think that comes later in life. I'm not really interested in art anymore. It's a funny thing, but I'm in my 60s now, and I find art very disappointing and trivial. I mean, all my life I've felt a little bit that way about artists and art and things that people thought were really great and so on. But some things did, you know, reach me, and now it's harder and harder for me to find anything that does. But I don't know, my sense of self is, well, I don't know about self is the right word, but self in the sense of my sense of being in reality, and I don't know, it is stronger. So maybe art's just a step along the way, but and you might be moving away from it
Yeah, well, that's
towards.
it's really.
I think you're. I sense, and I haven't had a chance. I think you're going to do some very important writing, but you know, that's why you're going through this hellish
Well,
period right now.
hopefully not only so I can write books, but
Well, since that's been important to
I'll
you,
be shackled to a tower of song myself. Yeah, I think
yeah.
it's a desirable side effect, and it can kind of be the proof, and maybe that's also what I'm getting at, is that, okay, talking about art, it's a psyop, put it simply. In my view, it's part of the social engineering arsenal, so don't trust it. However, self-expression, like an authentic expression of one's soul, that's allowing the psyche to experience life through the senses, that's what we're here for. I absolutely know that. What else could
Absolutely.
we be here for? And so there's this overlap or this blurring the line between self-expression, which is a child, playing, or a cat scratching its ear, or whatever it is. If it's real, it's fully embodied. That's self-expression, and that's something that can be commodified and idealized and turned into this cultural thing called art. But they're not mutually inclusive. I mean, I think a large part of what we think of as art isn't really authentic self-expression, and so that's what I'm discovering with Cohen is, wait a minute, this isn't who you are. This is a front. This is a cover. This is how you deal with what you are, and kind of deflect it, or dissemble, or conceal it, or kind of get the forgiveness of the masses
Right.
by, I mean, for example, as we talked about last week, if you own up to stuff in as poetry and people love you for it, you're like, oh, I'm in the clear then.
Yeah, it's
That
confession, love. Yeah,
that's an abuse of the art of the creative impulse, I think.
yeah, I think yeah, once it becomes ingrained in the person as a in the artist, or you know, in Cohen as his, that's how he functions, you know. It's like people going to confession, dumping all their sins, and then going back out and doing it again. And I've known sociopathic personalities who are junkies for forgiveness. They're always trying to, you know, squeeze forgiveness out of people. And then once they get it, you know, it's a victory for them, and then they go back and they do something horrific again. I've known people like that, you know, and I think he's in a little bit in that category of person, you know. It's a very, I think he scored, well, I was told by one of his girlfriends that he told her he scored very high on the sociopath, you know, testing for sociopathy. And I agree. But it's because he's cold as ice, you know, in many ways, but he can also melt your heart. What is that? There's not too many people like that.
I greet you from the other side of sorrow and despair, where they love so vast and shattered, it will reach you everywhere, and I
I
An interesting juxtaposition, and that's you're actually quoting the song that I put up here because I wanted to give an example, not that you need it, but just for when there's people listening to this. I smile when I'm angry, I cheat and I lie, I do what I have to do to get by, and I'm always alone, and my heart is like ice and it's crowded and cold in my secret life. That's the one that you quoted your piece, and then there's one at the song that's in the True Detective show.
That's a great series. Yeah, no, is that him? Is that Cohen?
That's him at the beginning. Yeah, so it's the song Nevermind, and then the lines, I was not caught though many tried, I live among you well disguised, I had to leave my life behind, I dug some graves you'll never find, the story's told with facts and lies, I had a name but never mind.
That's very succinct, and you know, that's a very succinct summary. Yeah, I saw that, but I didn't know the source. I assumed it was Cohen, but I didn't know where it came from.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've got to. If people aren't ready for this, you know, then they haven't been paying attention, you know, for the last 20 years. If they're not ready to hear this message, mm-hmm. then and understand that there's been a whole separate life going on there. That mm-hmm. I you know, I would say, but I mean, I want to finish my book eventually, and I'll be saying, I want to say things like this. You know, you have some amazing, you said some very fascinating and wonderful things, by the way. I've been listening to you. I hope you're right about,
okay,
I hope
thanks.
You're right about this, but now my mind just went blank. What was I talking about? It's two separate careers. That's what I believe. I mean, I love to state things very, you know, flatly. And visually and simply and so on, but I see two separate careers going on, and they're really two absolutely parallel. Maybe there are more than two, but I see two, you know, mm-hmm. parallel lives being led, and one is the cover for the other.
Right. So they're not separate in a certain sense. They're not. In one sense, they seem completely.
They feed each other, and he gets his inspiration from the from The Secret Career. And if you want to read us, you can see confirmation of that in some of the songs. Mm-hmm. Later, and especially maybe the later ones, My Secret Life, yeah, and Going Home. Have you seen that one? Or Show Me the Place. I can't even bring myself to listen to these later albums. So, and I've got
no,
to
I've,
sit
I've
down
left, to it. Yeah, I've lost interest. I haven't listened to his last few albums at
it's
all.
It's too late, but the confessions are coming, but they're, you know, the confessions are coming. He's making, summing things up, but I mean, I think just to go back to the very beginning, I think it was mm-hmm. predetermined. I think it was before he was born. I think his career was, in some ways, he's created it very much on his own, and he's a genius in a certain way. He's created himself, you know, and I think he deserves all the credit for having created Leonard Cohen. But on the other hand, I think much of his life was possibly predetermined from birth, and I think could I say, you know, I mean, I think he was born into a crime family. In fact, a syndicate, a group of families, and I think they ordained his, you know, they set him up. And I think through parts of his life, I think art was art was a kind of a form of confession and trying to save himself, because I think he's been suicidal often. And mm-hmm. he would have liked, and I think he had a side of him that was like anyone, like us, didn't want to rebel, you know, didn't want to be what they wanted him to be, and found, you know, and sort of found his way through it and compromised here, and oh, I'll do this for a while and then I'll do what I really want to do, and sometimes bargained with people, you know. I think he knew things. For example, when he wrote Beautiful Losers, I just have a sense that he blackmailed. He used that as a threat, although, you know, it's pretty incoherent. But if you were on the inside, military intelligence, you would read that book and you'd say, you know, he's about to blow the whistle on us. I think that's a possible interpretation. And he used that as leverage to then move further. And I think he's very clever, a very professional, you know, strategist, a poker player, you know. He can bluff his way out of many situations. I think he's been in many situations that he's had to bluff his way out of, including, you know, the Bay of Pigs and all that. And he's just mm-hmm. very good at that. And I think some of those skills come from being part of an underworld family, really. And I think he wasn't alone. And some of the people we mentioned earlier that were in London with him came from families that were linked. Now, you know, by common connections.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes up very high, you know. But, you know, I don't want to, yeah.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it myself.
I think that would explain the ambivalence throughout his life, that he actually has been, you know, in opposition to himself, to who he is. He's had two separate personalities. His family didn't agree with him going into music. His mother didn't want it. You know, they wanted him to go into the family business to begin with, supposedly, the clothing business, I don't know, but which didn't exist anymore. So I think there's a lot of unanswered things there, but I think he's, you know, in some ways he's just like us. You know, when he was a teenager and he was, you know, he wasn't always a slave to their plan. He must have, you know, screwed up. He did, you know.
Well, when you say he's just like us, of course, that's quite a loaded phrase, because he may well be just like us because we're just like him, if you see what I mean. But
that's as in
if we were inducted into something similar in different ways. But of course, we're different in the sense that we didn't turn out to be, you know, cultural icons shaping the collective psyches.
Right, and so, which can be a huge, you know, the way, during the period when I knew him, which was in the 80s and 90s, or 80s, basically, his iconhood was, you could see it was a huge obstacle, you know, impediment. Like,
sure.
And he would complain, you know. And, the idea of you're an artist, if you're Andy Warhol, you've got to keep turning out Andy Warhol, you know. Or if you're Robert Rauschenberg, you've got to be Robert. You've got to turn out Robert. You can't explore and become someone else and find out what you really want to write about. You've got to keep turning out those Leonard Cohen songs.
This brings back to something I did want to go back to, which was you were saying whether people are ready for it or not. I think that that's a very relevant question, like, because I think there is a growing climate of readiness. I mean, Jimmy Savile was a blessing in many ways, not him himself, I suppose, but the fact that all of that came out has kind of changed the public perception of what's going on. And even in the US, to some extent, there's not to the same extent, but to some extent, there's a growing recognition of what's going on behind the scenes of the entertainment industry. There was a documentary called An Open Secret in the US this year, which hasn't really found a distributor. There's been legal action, what have you, but it's about pedophilia in Hollywood. And
it was a woman director, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I read about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, where was I going with this? Oh,
there's a change in climate. I mean, you know, there's a lot going on in a lot of stuff about Hollywood coming out. Not just that documentary, but many YouTube, you know, mind control, Hollywood.
Well, so that was kind of where I was going with this, was because, as you know, I don't have that kind of podcast. I mean, I used to be alternate perceptions researcher and paranoid awareness proponent, and I've written books about it. I had another identity, Aeolus Caphus, and that was the first podcast I did, Stormy Weather, and it was very much about what I called Masonic sorcery theatre. I never, even back then, I didn't like the term Illuminati, but because, you know, once it's been used, it's all soiled, and it's like it's going to come up with new terms to describe these things anyway. But I'm even moving away from a conspiratorial mindset because, A, it's been so sullied, and, B, I just think it's insufficient to explain what's going on. Because I no longer think that culture is propped up by conspiracies so much as that culture itself is a kind of conspiracy, or what we think of as a conspiracy. So, like, the whole thing, I mean, from day one, has been engineered by hidden forces, so it's kind of Icean, but again, David Icke literalizes things too much for my taste. And of course, it creates this margin, this sort of populated margins, where people who sense that something is not right and it's not what it seems, who can no longer, or less and less able to believe the official story, can gather and compare notes, and potentially that's really a positive thing, like what we're doing. But what happens, I find, is that people kind of huddle together and they group together and they create this group mind, and because they want, it's very frightening, to put it mildly, to be letting go of the structures of belief that have propped up our identities, and to start realizing that you don't really know what's real and unreal. That's very threatening, and so the tendency is to
put together
a new interpretation system. So I call that the second matrix. It's like, it's a trick. Here's the red pill, but actually the red pill's not a red pill, it's just a hallucinogen. And then when you're under the drugs, like Paul Whitley Strieber, they whisk you off and make you think that you've been abducted by aliens and you're the alien messiah, right? And so, but actually no, you're just another socially engineered shill or puppet, and you're just reinforcing the old program. And so that's the first thing. And then the other thing is weirdly sort of congruent with this, which is that I do want to reach people who aren't familiar with this stuff in a way that they will actually be able to receive it and accept it. You know, the people who, in my view, have rightly rejected David Icke and Whitley Strieber and the Illuminati because it is so tainted. They might have done it for the wrong reasons, because they just couldn't deal, and they were just, you know, too rigid and inflexible. But at the same time, it wasn't. Again, it was laced with strychnine. That whole kind of thing. So then I've got this podcast, which is, you know, I have Jonathan Leatham, Temple Grandin, and I've got people in the culture who are talking to me. And of course, just strategically, if I get too weird, their agents or their people are going to go, don't go near that guy. So it's kind of weird. There's these several different agendas for me, reasons or motivations why I absolutely need to be as kind of grounded as possible. Of course, the main one is for me. I'm off the map now. Like, I had a map. I thought I had a map. Didn't really represent the terrain, but I thought it did. So whether it was Strieber or Castaneda or Leonard Cohen or, you know, that seemed to represent my internal reality, but it didn't. It was an imitation. It was always going to be, because we have to make our own map. Maybe we don't even have to make a map, actually, because we just need to explore the terrain. But I think there's a map creating thing that helps us feel, helps me feel safe. You're talking about writing as one of the best therapeutic tools. If I write it down, that creates a certain amount of distance, and it's kind of a safe space. So talking to you is a way that I can let into consciousness stuff that I wouldn't feel safe letting into consciousness if I was alone.
Well, that's it. It's amazing to be able to have I never have a dialogue about this sort of thing, 'cause, you know, certainly not at this level, you know, where, because you of your background and the fact that you're from another world, because you're from England, you know, but at the same, and you're from another, you're a different generation. I think we're about 16 years apart, or 17 years, something like that. So, you know, it's almost another generation, and but the way you've explored all this, and the way and post Jimmy Savile, like you say, it did change everything. You know, I know in England, people here haven't heard of him. I mean, in Montreal, people don't know who he is. But you know, I follow that. I've been following that and that whole story. And I see the parallels for sure between him and some other people I could name. But you know, it's just to be. Yeah, I'm just so impressed by what you're able to articulate.
That's something that is kind of part of my social engineering, I suppose, because I was articulate as a child, and that was even a big part of my persona, so the parents were kind of proud of how eloquent I was, and they would put me in front of the adults at these parties where who all knows what else went on. I don't have memory of it, but I was kind of paraded as this precocious, actually Aspergerian now is how I see it, little professor kid who would tell these funny stories to the grown-ups. And so eloquence has been a weapon in my arsenal for a long time, and anyway, that's possibly a digression, but in terms of using it now more in a more whole, healthy way, I suppose, to integrate stuff. I mean, talking about stuff is a way to actually allow it to come into awareness, paradoxically. I mean, just that the stuff I might not have even thought until I hear myself saying it. I mean, that's the potential of eloquence, I think.
Who by fire, who by water, who in the sunshine, who in the night time, who by high or deep, who by common trial, who in your merry, merry month of May, who by very slow decay, and who shall I say is calling, and who in her lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in this rance of love, who by something blunt, and who by avalanche, who by powder, who for his green, who for his
The other thing about the way you think, you don't think in terms of enemies. You know, you don't have, you're not trying to identify who the enemy is. You see it all as a kind of, you seem to see it as a process, you know, and you know, things just seem to, well, as you frame things, you know, and you spin out these ideas and so on. You don't seem to be fixated on the idea that you're going to find what the source, who to blame, you know. Because obviously, there's no one group, and there's no one source for all these things that are going on. But there are definitely groups, you know, and agendas and plans and things we've been. I'm just, you know, talking to you. I kind of wake up to, you know, we're pawns. We really have been pawns in something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and it's culture. We've really been pawns of culture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your generation was pawn. You are. Would you call yourself? Wait a sec. Now you're born in 67.
Yeah.
You're sort of Gen. Are you Gen X?
Yeah.
Yeah. But collectors. You're great collectors of everything and connoisseurs.
Oh, really?
Right?
I don't know that part.
Did you know
I
that?
Know we're the sort of whatever generation, the jaded generation. That's about all I
Is
know.
Is that
about.
What they say? Yeah. But my generation were naive. You know, innocent kind of. Well, I don't know. Yeah, post-war.
So you're a baby boomer.
Baby boomers, and you know, we have all those characteristics of baby boomers. I used to be a little bit oriented to astrology. I thought it gave a good, you know, there were certain things with Pluto and Leo.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say very, but I definitely refer to it. I just refer to my transits this week, and they're massive. I mean, not this week's, but over the next few months, I've got enormous number of major transits, and I put just enough stock in that, not too much. So.
No, not too much. It's sometimes very useful metaphor, you know. But anyway, so yeah, your generation is more thoughtful, and you know, it seems like as a generation more critical, more on the side of criticism and analysis. Possibly.
Could be.
Could be.
Certainly describes me, anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Lenin's generation were obedient. Obedient, you know, to authority. My generation were rebellious.
That's interesting because that speaks to what you're saying about not blaming and not finding someone to blame, because one of the things we do culturally, I think, is we always blame previous generations for not being as enlightened as we are, kind of thing, and it's really ignorant. We're actually betraying our own ignorance if we do that. I don't think I do it particularly, but I think it is a cultural phenomenon. And so, yeah, it is. I mean, and I'm glad that you're saying that thing about me not looking for the enemy, because I feel that I do that, and
but
I don't want to do it.
You haven't named a single one in this conversation. You haven't, like, you haven't said it's the Jews or it's Freemasons, you know?
Well, that's because I don't know. I mean, I know that I don't know, but I mean, I've had, this has happened to me so many times that I've had somebody that I looked up to, and then I found out, wait a minute, they're not what they seem. And there's always been an element of blame. And so this is the latest incarnation of that with Leonard.
I
loved Leonard, and now I'm thinking, holy fuck, Leonard, you betrayed me. The reenactment, the traumatic reenactment. And I haven't felt any anger against Cohen, but
you have the right to those feelings. Those are not, that's not outrageous, you know. You have the right to feel slightly betrayed. I mean, I just wanted to say, by talking about him as much as I do, I think it's because I could go on about why I keep talking about it. I'm trying to finish, I'm trying to get around to arrive at what I actually think about him, or about, but not so much him as everything he's part of, and everything that's been hidden. That's how I sort of see it, He's brought it to light, as far as I'm concerned. In my life, he's brought things to light. I mean, so he's brought me a lot of insight and information. He's even when he's been very tight-lipped, but because he's not exactly Mr. I'll reveal everything about myself so you can get to know me. He's definitely always secretive, but I've learned about secrecy through him, and all the different levels of it, and so on. So I'm very grateful to him in many ways, but I had to pass through, a lot of damage has been done, and it's not just, I had to get through the personal damage, and then I kind of got through that, partly because now it's Kelly Lynch, I can sort of live vicariously through what she's going through. I can see the same potential, the same hatred for women, basically, coming through there, and the refusal to deal with them as human beings. But to either, place them on a pedestal or absolutely destroy them. And that's what he does. I had that done to me. But, I never was told, he never said a word to me about what he was feeling. He's incapable of it. He's incapable of expressing an emotion. And that's his generation, too, of men. And that's the military. And it's all of that. But, then with time, you forgive this stuff. And then now I'm on to the phase that I think that's where we come together, you and I, of seeing how it's affected, a collective, a generation or two generations, or, a whole world, a whole scene, you have to be in to try to understand it and take it apart. And so he's just one player in that. But he, in some ways, he's an important player, because in some ways he's like the last man standing in some ways. There's very few 60s people left, and he's the most articulate. He's the god. He's the grandfather. He seems to be the one that gets the most. Certainly can't stop interviewing him. He has, he never stops talking in a way about, about many things. He's I don't know how many, if you counted the words, but he's certainly had a lot to say. But how many others are left like him? And I think he's going to go out with the last word, just because he gets to talk so much. And I think I don't think he should go out with the last word. I think someone should, someone should expose
him. Upstage him.
Someone should just deliver, another narrative than the one he's gotten away with for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, that's legitimate. That's not destructive. That's not.
No, I face this dilemma with my brother. I mean, he's gone now, but he's left this legacy of a false narrative, and it affects me to this day, because I lived under the spell and under the weight of that false narrative, and the fact that even in his death, or through his death partly, he's left this legacy of deception, in which I'm cast in a completely incorrect role or a false light. It bothers me. It does bother me.
Of course it would. Yeah.
So, and of course, you're part of Cohen's story. I mean, you're actually omitted from the biography, I guess. You're certainly not on his wiki page, and of course it's clear to see why not. Because you could be on his wiki page. We could arrange that right now, of course. But it might not stay up for long.
But I was relieved. You did ask me that question. I noticed I wasn't. I did want to make sure that I wasn't mentioned. I didn't want to be mentioned. It was never, It was never easy or simple. To. No, you know, I'd rather be invisible. I'm that kind of person too.
But you're writing books now, so
but
that
now
contradicts
I've,
that.
I've reached that age, you know, where it doesn't really matter anymore.
Mm.
That does come later, you know.
Have you thought about reaching out to Cohen now, while he's still around?
He wouldn't. It has occurred to me, but he's 81. I don't see any reason for it, because I think when he goes, you know, whenever that might be, it's up to him to frankly, I see it in terms of some kind of redemption scenario,
mm-hmm.
and I it's up to him. He'll make the choice. I think he's in some ways comfortable with the idea of going to hell, and I think in many ways that's where he's going, and I don't say that.
The Jews don't have a hell, do they?
Sorry?
The Jews don't even have an afterlife, I think.
Well, I think they. Do you know what? I think they believe in. I think they do have a hell, but. Yeah,
that interview I just read. He said somebody asked him about the afterlife, and all he said was, "I hope there isn't one."
Well, I'm trying to think of something to say to that. I think they believe in physical resurrection.
But that's Christian.
Armageddon.
Thing.
I think Armageddon.
You could check this. Armageddon is Christian too. It's all got mixed up, and we don't want to get off on this tangent.
We can't go there.
We're supposed
to
be winding up. So let's come back to you talking to Cohen.
You go to heaven when you've been to hell. That's from that awful album of Phil Spector, you know.
I don't remember that line, and I never listened to the album except Hard On, which I like. But it's actually an Aeolus Capus line, which is tickets to paradise are available, but you have to go to hell to get them.
Who said that?
That was I wrote that in Aeolus Capus, yeah.
Oh, good, yes, right. That's
so, yeah, me and Leonard, peas in a pod.
Yeah.
It just seems to me he's 81. That's the time to make amends. I mean, you talk about redemption. Once you die, isn't it too late? Isn't it what you do in this life that counts?
Yeah, but I'm not sure he sees any point to it. I think he's worried about his kids. And I think that if he were to reveal, I don't think he's ever going to go there. Tell what really went on. I think he's left it up to us to figure it out. I think, and some people say, why do you waste your time on this? You know, but I think there's a lot there that we need to know, and
mm-hmm.
we can learn from this. But I doubt that he's going to do it. I think the main reason being he'd be afraid of repercussions for his children.
If he came clean, sure. But of course, the flip side of that is the false legacy that they have to carry, and they're burdened with that false history.
I think the closest anyone will come is this Kelly Lynch story.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt it'll ever be exposed. You know, well, I doubt that she'll ever really get any kind of justice. But I think if the truth were known, that would expose everything, and it would be like Jimmy Savile, the house of cards would just collapse.
Mm.
You know, I really do think that he's a little bit on the. I think he's very worried about that happening.
Yeah.
But you know,
two. I mean, there's two separate things here. One is Cohen's empire and the edifice of deceit, let's say, or the misrepresentation of his public image, and all of that. And the other is your relationship with him, like you as two human beings.
Why are you bringing me? Oh, you mean in terms of our interview? The things we're talking about here, or
well, right. I mean, I mean, well, it's kind of it's there's different layers to it, I suppose. I mean, I'm curious at a personal level, probably rather vainly, if Leonard Cohen would actually be interested, if he's aware of you, and he'd be interested enough. If he knew about this podcast, would he actually listen to it? That's a kind of just a weird question I have, and then that leads me to think about, well, in terms, like, for me, it's impersonal. Like, Cohen, I never met him. If that feeling of betrayal's got nothing to do with him, he didn't betray me. But for you, it's a lot more personal. So
it gets less personal with time. Yeah. You know, it's a lot less personal. Writing about it. I've been writing about it for a while because 20 years ago, I thought I'd just write a book about knowing him. Why not? You know, everybody does that. You know, mm-hmm. when I'm with, you know, like, what's her name? I'm with the band, right? What was her name? Writing about the Rolling Stones. Anyway, you know, mm-hmm. and why not write about knowing a pop star? I can make some money. You know, that's how I was thinking 20 years ago. And I'll just write a funny story. I'll write about all the weird things that happened that I never understood and why, you know. And mm-hmm. I kind of still set out to do that when I wrote that memoir that that I sent you. Mm-hmm. The Man Next Door, right? It's the same idea. I'll keep it light, but it was impossible to keep it light. I can live in denial, you know, and I can pretend it was, you know, simple, you know, funnier than it was. There, you know, but ultimately, that's not a very good book, you know, to only talk about the to write a little hell-raising narrative, but you know, never really delve too deeply. It was, yeah. So mm-hmm. it was in reading the biographies and realizing there are actual lies, right? He's actually publishing lies. That it's not just mistakes or omissions, but mm-hmm. real lies. And I don't, you know, and the fact that I'm omitted. I mean, I couldn't see, like I said, and I wouldn't see it any other way. I was never acknowledged as being part of his life. The whole time I knew him, people didn't believe I knew him. You know, it's just, I'm used to that. I wanted it that way. It was not fun to be too closely associated with him. Most of the women that tried to, you know, they ended up, they were serious bleeding casualties, you know. And I don't identify with, you know, we didn't have that, we didn't have a passionate, you know. We just had some kind of thing that went on for a while. I think it goes back to my childhood. I think that's why it seems so profound, you know, at the time. But I'm not important. The only thing that could happen is that I might be able to tell a better story and a more inclusive story than most of the others, because the biographers don't know him. They get, you know, led by the nose. And Sylvie Simmons even said it. She said, you can't, she gave an interview later, after the book was published, just a few months ago, and she said, you know, you don't know when he's pulling the wool over your eyes. Because I think she'd realized a few things in the, about the biography are not even, you know, are not necessarily true and all that. But her name's on it.
Right.
And so I just look at it as, I look at the whole thing as it's still a work in progress. Most of my anger, I think, is gone. I don't get that. I don't feel angry anymore. It's more that I feel I can go right back to the beginning, even of his life, and see what that was. And that's, if you can do that, I think you can forgive a lot of things. You know, if you can really understand someone and their origins, what they were faced with. I think families are, you know, can be like slaughterhouses of children. You have no idea, as an infant, what you're getting into when you're born into a family, you know.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, and that's true for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of us.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
So that's the end of the fourth part of my discussion with Anne Diamond. There's also a fifth MP3 with a section of our conversation which didn't make the final cut. I will perhaps be continuing to explore this mystery and the intrigue around Leonard Cohen. I'd like to talk to Kelly Lynch, who is his manager, who was imprisoned for 18 months a few years ago on charges of harassment, having first been accused by Cohen of stealing his fortune. Cohen and Chis's version of events is very different than Cohen's and the official narrative that's made it to the mainstream. And I think there's a lot there that needs to be looked at and questioned, so I hope to have the opportunity to do so at some point. If you've got any other suggestions or leads to follow around Cohen Gate, just let me know, and I'll be sure to follow them up. It's been a very satisfying experience talking to Anne Diamond, and I plan to do it again, if not for this podcast, for my own pleasure, or in whatever capacity. If you're interested in hearing more from Anne Diamond on this podcast, let me know. Otherwise, you can find and follow Anne's work yourself by going to annediamond.net and various blogs and things that she has going on. That's about all for this week. I don't have a guest lined up for next week. I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm sure that something will come through in the last minute.
So the monkey's boot when his world came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Monkey spoke when his leg came.